All right, so Mitch, jump in when you want as well, and any other speakers. Let me start with a question for Howard. Howard, you mentioned that the at these live events, at these virtual events, that some of the exhibitors are not happy with the traffic going through their events. I mean, in reality, they paid for it. They're the ones who so desire these events to be successful. Why is traffic not up to speed, and to what extent, why do we have these trade shows to begin with? What are they trying to, what are their objectives? Are they trying to find people who are seemingly uninterested in a subject, kind of wander by, enter their thing, and then be shocked and surprised, and then be more interested in learning about their product, and they're not doing that virtually? Or is there something about the in-person relationships that develop that goes on in a live experience? And I guess to go back to the point, why do we have these trade shows to begin with, and how can virtual create a similar experience that is as effective?
So, to answer your question, a lot of people were wondering why we have these events, and I think the question is really, what's the ROI for participating in them? As to why they're hosted, the most common reason is because they make money. In many cases, they're put on by associations, and these are often the biggest source of revenue for those organizations. Then there are also for-profit events that are simply designed to make money. In terms of why an exhibitor would take out a booth and, you know, pay for the booth build out and shipping their merchandise and having sales team, you know, take a few days out of the office, presumably it's to raise awareness for their product and to engage with customers on a more direct basis. But before COVID hit, this was already a conversation that was taking place because the trade show hosts were sort of looking at the exhibitors as basically walking ATMs, and they really didn't put nearly as much effort into making sure that they got the value they needed out of those shows. So I think the reason that it's not clicking as much in virtual is that they're, and I'm talking about virtual platforms where you click on an icon in a virtual lobby and it says Expo Floor and you go in there and it's a very interactive environment. You could click on different booth vendors and you can chat in video real time with that exhibitor's representative. So it's a very dynamic interface. But the problem is when you're at a live trade show, there's this visceral sense of excitement and stimulation that you get from walking the show floor. That doesn't necessarily translate into business for all the exhibitors, but it sort of feels like they need to be there. They've found it hard to kind of drive virtual attendees to spend time in those virtual booths. The interaction is there, the technology is there, the user interface is there. Just as an attendee, it's just not this dramatically compelling.
So let me do a comparison of an industry like the trade show versus like a consumer trade show, because I think a number of us have gone to consumer trade shows for sure. So let me use like the auto show as an example. So you know, currently I've gone, I don't know, maybe for the last three of the last five auto shows. The place is packed. I went to the Javits Center. It's full of people. Everyone's kind of walking around, very interested in what they have to show. It seems to be, you know, brand promotion. It seems to be specific product promotion. People go there when they think they're going to buy a car. Others just go there when they're just kind of interested. And there's a certain level of excitement. The thought that I would be perusing Ford or General Motors websites as an alternative seems, you know, inconceivable to me. So starting with the consumer show, how effective can it be on a virtual basis relative to the level of excitement that occurs in a bona fide consumer show?
Well, in an example like you gave, it's going to take some time to come close to replicating. It's not going to replicate it. And using that auto show as an example of what you asked earlier, the host and the owner of the New York Auto Show is the New York Auto Dealers Association. They were a client of my agency's for a number of years. And that was basically all the tri-state area, you know, car dealerships were the ones who were members and technically owners of that association, which put on the show. So it's designed to get people excited about the new car models that are coming out and get people thinking about going into a dealership to buy a car. I think it's going to be hardest to replicate the shows that had physical products. So CES, you know, a lot of that's about the oohs and ahs of the latest, you know, TV screens, et cetera. And the car shows are going to have a harder time pivoting and transitioning online. That being said, if you have a lot of people that are simply not going to, I mean, that show drew over a million consumers, you're not going to be able to replicate that experience, but you don't want to just let it disappear. So they're going to have to come up with a lot of sort of almost virtual reality things that replace that. But there are a lot of shows that did not have physical products. I mean, you think about finance and insurance. You know, there's nothing really that you touch and feel. You don't sit in an insurance product and feel and smell the leather. So some, you know, industries are going to have an easier time migrating to virtual than others.
Well, that goes I'll call it an idea conference, which you would think ideas are perfect for the Zoom, but it reminds me a little bit, I've never gone to the Milken Institute events in Beverly Hills that occurs every year, but one of my business partners does. And what he says to me is, you know, it's incredible, Larry. You can watch all the shows online if you want. I said, well, did you sit on anything? He said, well, I mostly use my time there to interact with other people, make new business contacts, and continue existing ones. Are these trade shows really just social events where people can meet and either meet new people or cultivate existing relationships? And to what extent are they just a backdrop to what's going on?
So I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, if you look at the TED Talk model, you could see the talks for free online, but you pay to go there and be able to mingle and you know, talk and interact with the high-level quality of the attendees. In a lot of cases, the reason that the content is there is in order for the attendees to be able to get the attendance fees reimbursed by their employer. If it's just a boondoggle, then you know their company won't pay for it. Not to say that the content's not worthwhile, but I think it's that serendipitous interaction of people that is probably hardest to visualize migrating to virtual, but it's definitely a doable thing. I mean, a lot of money has been going into the networking and the serendipitous meeting aspect of virtual. And in some ways, it's actually better because when you sign up to attend a virtual conference online, you can indicate a lot of preferences of who you want to meet and the kind of people that you want to meet and talk to. And it's much, much easier to match those people with facilitated one-on-one or small group interactions. So I don't think the in-person conference is going to stop, but you're right in the sense that a lot of the value is not in the session rooms. It's in the, you know, the foyer and in those events, mm-hmm. you know, in the evenings as well.
Mitch, you have a question for Wendy?
Yeah. So Wendy, I was curious, how much do these companies that you're working with and you've talked to know yet or are sophisticated about where budgets are coming from? I mean, currently they're saving money with some of what's going on with the pandemic, but what about on an ongoing basis? I mean, for example, you talked about the Silicon Valley companies are some of the first ones to say, you know, don't ever come back to work. And what some of these companies are doing that I've read about is saying, you know, we'll give you, you know, $20,000 and you get to move to another city where the cost of living is cheaper than San Francisco, where most tech companies are, but we're going to cut your salary by 10%. So I think there's going to be a lot of shifting around. Go ahead, Wendy.
Yeah, no, good question. You know, from the companies that I've spoken to, and I'm not talking to the largest Silicon Valley ones that are really very tech forward and ahead of the curve, they actually are not really sure. They're like kind of taken off guard, and they're all of a sudden they're scrambling to try to figure out how to do it. I kind of think it talks about like what Howard was saying about 2020's functionality, how to make it work. And so a lot of them are telling me that, you know, they can't order promotional products, they're not doing anything live, but somehow they're going to find money for virtual events. So I think they're just doing it by the seat of their pants now, and maybe in 2021 we'll start to see more of a budget for it.
You know, if I could just tack on to what Wendy said. I think another point that she's probably seeing is a lot of these organizations are struggling with onboarding new employees. And, you know, how do you do that when the employees aren't even able to visit the office? So, you know, it's not just about, you know, building morale and culture among existing employees. You know, people forget how hard it is to join a company when you can't set foot in the office and physically meet everybody. So I think that's going to be a big part of it as well.
Yeah, and you know what? And everybody's kind of scrambling to find the these virtual events. And the interesting thing to me is that there's going to be so much creativity, kind of like what Howard's talking about in 2021, refining the experience, that we're going to start to see some really interesting ideas to help onboard employees, you know, keep employees, you know, for retreats and conferences. We'll start to see a lot of innovation with them.
You know how we seem to be getting a little bit of Zoom fatigue, I've heard. And there's something very special about face-to-face and in-person that's different. To what extent do you think, and maybe my question is directed for Wendy on this one, you know, we're going to try to create that water cooler experience using in-person, but it seems very artificial in many ways. You know, we can have these drinks, you know, on Zoom, the mixology and wine tasting ones you suggested, but it's somehow different than actually being at the bar. Why, first of all, will it work the first couple of times and then sort of not be that effective? What is so special about in-person experiences that the virtual experience can't achieve?
Well, I mean, I think in person, people love to see each other. It's just part of human nature. And I do agree that there's Zoom fatigue, but if something's done interactively where you really enjoy speaking to somebody and you have a topic or there's some sort of structure to it, I think people forget about the Zoom fatigue because you're getting that interaction that you're longing for that you don't get in person. So if the events are done correctly and you have an experience where you're really interacting, like I mentioned, that company that's doing 19 sessions, they're in there talking and laughing and joking with each other. So it's not passive, it's, you know, interactive. And I think that's what you get in the person. The Zoom or the webinar thing where you're just sitting and listening, that can't replace in person.
I'll add to that I think Zoom fatigue is kind of bullshit, because I think a lot of it has to do with the quality of the experience. You look at how people will spend hours and days playing interactive multiplayer video games, and it's not the screen that's the barrier. You know, they're talking to people through headsets, and you can't pull them out of the room. So, you know, to Wendy's point, I think if experience it's not just the technology, it's obviously the heavy lifting is in how you implement it to make it an engaging experience.
So, Wendy, how do you think this intra-corporate activities will accelerate? How do you think employees will engage with these sort of, you know, fun events or training, or how do you handle what Howard was mentioning before about how do we bring in a new employee and get them engaged? And at the end of the day, is the rub really here we're trying to get corporate retention of employees? And if we start to notice greater and greater turnover, to what extent will people view this as problematic and encourage in-person corporate events to get that culture going?
Well, I mean, again, I think it really boils down to being interactive. So, it has to be interactive. It can't be just another webinar where somebody's onboarding employees and they're just lecturing, because that's boring, and then people have their three screens and they're doing other things. If they're being engaged and they're having to talk and participate, I think that it will be successful. I think, you know, there's never going to be a replacement for in-person, but after COVID is over, nobody is all going to be in person anymore. So you're going to need to have these kind of events on a regular basis. And, you know, this is where the whole new market and new challenges is to come up with things that actually are interactive, not lectures, webinar-based.
Okay. All right, this is the part of the show where we pivot to ending with a few comments about optimism. What I mean by that is during this COVID experience and in the 31 weeks of this show, we sometimes get very pessimistic about the economic decline and the virus. So I thought we could go around and ask each person what they're optimistic about. Howie, I'm going to start with you. What are you optimistic about out of this?
So sticking to my lane, I'm going to pick something that I think is not typically thought of. Obviously, I'm optimistic about how quickly the industry adapted to virtual, but what I'm going to point out is that a lot of people with disabilities have a hard time at conferences and events. You know, think of someone in a wheelchair having to navigate a conference center or a large convention center, and they're usually not at the front of the room often in terms of where they're positioned. Zoom or a virtual platform basically removes all of those barriers. You know, whether you're a shy person as well, you know, it presents an opportunity to democratize the playing field from a participant and attendee standpoint. And I think we're seeing a lot of awareness of that moving forward. So I'm actually encouraged by that.
Okay. Wendy, what about you?
Two things. First, this new thing where a lot of companies are going to be working remotely, even after COVID's over, I think it's just going to increase job satisfaction and increase the quality of life for a lot of people. They won't have those commutes and the stress and lose, you know, 2 to 4 hours a day of commuting. I just think that we're going to be a happier America. Like, Nicholas Kristof recently wrote that, you know, America falls in happiness in the world, you know, quality of life. Is like we're like number 28, and I think that this really can help us move up with a better quality of life. And then the second thing is that there's this whole new business segment that is going to arise for these virtual vendors, where a lot of these vendors were doing things locally or regionally, and now they can really perform their services for people all over the world, just like kind of like e-commerce has provided platforms for people to sell their products all over the world. Now they can sell their virtual talents all over the world. So I'm excited to see where that goes.
Okay. Rob Konecki? Rob, you still with us? All right, Mitch, do you want to end on a point of optimism?
Sure. I mean, I think what I mentioned in my earlier remarks and reiterating some of what Wendy was just saying, but, you know, I'm optimistic that flexibility about work from home, despite everyone giving it lip service for many years, is really finally acceptable and here to stay even after this pandemic ends. While it clearly won't make sense for everyone and even beyond some of the obvious people, there's evidence recently from Google that engineers are less productive working from home. But I think in addition to what Wendy talked about, you know, if you're not commuting 2 hours a day every day, it could really improve your life. You know, and I said last week, can maybe also help improve the environment. I mean, I live in Los Angeles, and ever since March, I think we've all noticed, you know, that the air is better. There's more creatures around. And I think that that's something that we're all starting to appreciate and would like to try to continue.
Okay. Mark Levinson, do you have anything you want to end on the optimistic side?
Sure. I think one thing about some of the trends in globalization that we talked about earlier is that they may relieve some of the wage pressures on blue-collar workers in this country. As manufacturing becomes more specialized and more technological in nature, and the workers have much higher skill levels, they're going to be doing higher value work, and they're going to be getting paid for it. And that's a change. Manufacturing workers have gotten kind of beaten around in recent years. So I think that's a good thing.
Hey, Larry, it's Rob. I found my mute button.
Oh, good. Welcome back.
Thank you. I think actually we're seeing that the pandemic is speeding up the pace of digital transformation, and that is actually going to, in the long run, have a positive effect for cybersecurity. We're moving away from these legacy antiquated systems that we can't work with remotely to ones in which we can. And so I'm seeing actually a speed up and an increase in investment in areas that are going to make us more secure in the long run.
Okay. Tim, I guess two-part question. One, I want you to talk about optimism, but I also received an email from Dan Juergen asking you to talk a little bit about the electrification of trucks and autos.
Well, actually, it's a one-part question. That's good news. That's what I'm optimistic about. I'm very optimistic about the electrification of the auto and truck industry and the cleaner air that should result. we've been extremely busy this year, especially. We've been working on electrification over the past 2 years, or three or four years, actually, on behalf of the incumbent truck makers, the suppliers, the fleets, and the disruptors and the SPACs who are financing them in a huge way this year. And we think there are a lot of applications that combine a local duty cycle with enough mileage, enough regenerative braking, and home-to-base operations that actually make the TCO, the total cost of ownership analysis, better than diesel, even at current industry costs. And those include school buses, medium-duty local delivery trucks, refuse trucks, transit buses, and yard spotters. So a bunch of niches, but we don't think Class 8 tractors are quite ripe for it yet, the over-the-highway trucks. Though, of course, Tesla has a significant cost advantage, and that could get them a lot closer, but they still need
and
to deliver.
So you're referring always to the short traffic, the short haul, with a lot of braking. Is that where the electric does a better job?
That's where it's doing best right now. I think Tesla still needs to sort of deliver on their ambitious battery cost reduction targets to get there on the longer haul stuff in the next few years, in my opinion. We've also been really involved in California's recently approved new low NOx and zero emissions vehicles, and NOx is nitrous oxides, regulations. And I can tell you the cost of the incumbent internal combustion engines is going to rise a lot in the coming years, which will make commercial EVs more cost competitive. And there's a lot of inertia in the auto and truck making industries, but with support from regulations, some big carbon reduction promises from the tech giants and other consumer brands, and just fundamental cost economics, I think the disruption from EVs is in all likelihood going to gain momentum in the next few years.
Thank you. Dr. Josh Schiffer, going way back to you, what are you optimistic about?
Yeah, so perhaps this is a bit personal, but I think the optimism I get on a day-to-day basis is simply seeing the dedication of my colleagues, both locally and around the country, and trying to fight this pandemic. Today, the White House Chief of Staff, Mark Meadows, was quoted as saying, "We're not going to control the pandemic." And I can just tell you firsthand, my interface with this virus has been on the front lines, seeing patients with colleagues. It's been with the Department of Health trying to model the local epidemiology, and it's been in terms of trying to design optimal trials for treatment and vaccines with colleagues at the Fred Hutch. And just nobody's subscribing to this point of view. It's all hands on deck. And, you know, without any question, it's been the most inspiring professional experience of my life. And that gives me a great deal of optimism despite these trying times.
That's great. Okay. With that, so that ends the regular scheduled program. I do want to make a plug alert for what we have going on next week. We're going to have epidemiologist Lauren Myers talk about R-naught and the pace of the COVID vaccine expanding. We're going to have Dr. Andrew Levine from UCLA. He's going to tell us about the fog and the neurological problems caused by COVID. Nicholas Bloom at Stanford will discuss, he's a professor at the business school. Heidi Gray is a childhood friend of mine who until recently was head of human resources at News Corp, the challenges that COVID is having in HR. Rory Stewart, who ran for prime minister in the UK, will discuss populism. and James Fishkin, a Stanford professor, will discuss public deliberation and helping us make public policy choices. All right, that's our lineup for next week. A final reminder that we've just opened the What Happens Next website, so if you want to re-listen to this program or listen to any of the programs live today, you can will be able to do so momentarily, and you can stay up to speed with regards to the agendas for the upcoming weeks. With that, I would like to thank my co-hosts, Rick Banks and Mitch Feynman, and I, of course, would like to thank each of the speakers for their time and efforts, and to our listeners, as always, for engaging. Thank you so much, and you may disengage at this time. Thanks again. Bye-bye.